Also, the acoustics are not very good here, and it's very, you know, it's quite hard. I mean, up here we can hear anything at the back, and if you could try and keep the noise to a minimum, because it is really difficult. And with that, I'm going to hand over tonight to our second speaker, who is Brian.
Thanks, Charlie. Hi, I'm Brian. I'm an addict. This morning I got up at about 6:30, and I found, when I came in yesterday, I live where, if they deliver parcels and things, there's nobody to sign for them and stuff, so to my amazement, the post office opened at 7. I thought it would wait till 9 o'clock or whatever, so I got up at, I woke up anyway at about 6, went to the post office, which has always been a real hassle, and I found the guy was really nice, he was really pleasant. I was a bit worried about what one of these things was going to be, and it was all fine. One was a sort of, it was a some business cards, and it was, they hadn't been able to stick it through the letterbox, and the other thing was just my car insurance. I thought it was going to be a writ or something like that. So I then went to the gym, and didn't exactly kill myself in the gym. But there were all these people there at like 7:30 in the morning really pounding the treadmill and stuff. I'm a doctor, and I know that if doctors could prescribe three things that would make us all feel better, it would be exercise, it would be good sleep, and good nutrition. And they can't prescribe that. It's up to us to get that together. I have to say, I don't really do any of them particularly well. When I say I'm an addict, what I mean by that is that I'm wired up differently. I don't think that's necessarily true for everybody who becomes an addict. I was an addict from the earliest thing that I remember, which was being in Singapore. I was born. Charlie said he wanted this to go from birth, not through death, because we haven't quite died yet, from birth till now, right? So I was born in Shrewsbury. My dad was in the Air Force and was posted to Singapore. And my first memories are in Singapore. When my brother was born, don't really have much to say about it, except my, when I was, life was a series of different Air Force bases, different kind of postings in England, in France, in Germany, and when I was older in America, so I didn't really have a home, and it's something that I'm very aware of now, actually, that I've never really had a home, and if I don't have a trip lined up, I get kind of itchy feet, so I like to have a trip to look forward to. Is this mic working all right, by the way? Is it? Are we not popping too much or anything? So I went to about 15 different schools, and I was fine. I mean, I really did not have any kind of disadvantaged childhood. There was quite a lot of moving around. I had a brother 4 years younger. My dad was a pilot. And in France, I took 11 plus. And then after that, came back to England, went to a prep school in Suffolk, which for me was a really good thing. I mean, it took me a year to settle down, and then I then went up, stayed at boarding school till I was 18. So I went to the prep school, and the first time I took a mood-altering drug was a bottle of sherry when I was 12. And I remember that as if it was yesterday. Now, I don't know, I don't remember the first time I took chocolate, I don't remember the first time I had lobster, I remember the feeling I got when I was drinking sherry at the age of 12 as if it was yesterday. And the guy I was drinking it with, he started throwing up, and I remember thinking, great, there's going to be more of that left for me. And it really made a difference. I was just sort of, I was singing, I was behaving stupidly, and it was a sign of things to come. And there's no question that whenever I drank afterwards, if we were playing football or whatever, the bus would stop in Ipswich, we're supposed to go and get fish and chips, a couple of drinks would go down as fast as possible. I never drank alcohol because I liked the taste of it. Most of the time I didn't. I actually subsequently did like the taste of vintage port, actually, but that's about the only alcoholic drink I really enjoyed the taste of. But I really liked the effect of it. And whenever I drank, which wasn't particularly frequently when I was at school and stuff, so I did okay at school, got my A-levels, was captain of tennis, captain of athletics, so I was a pretty good 440 yards runner. It was 440 yards in those days, so I've still got the Suffolk under 18 440 yard record, because the following year they changed it to 400 metres. sole claim to fame. And it was all fine. I was sort of backwards and forwards to America when I was at school. My dad was in America for 4 years, and I became very influenced by all things American. Came back, went to... I had a gap year between A-levels and college, and in that gap year, I discovered marijuana on Mission Beach in San Diego. And I actually went to San Francisco in 1967, but I got there too late. Everybody was kind of... I mean, standing there listening to Jerry Garcia doing a 20-minute guitar solo when you had a Budweiser instead of being stoned on acid or something else was a bit dull. I found San Francisco pretty dull, and by the time I got there, it just wasn't, you know, the rot had set in, there was a lot of drugs, and what I thought were a lot of phony kind of high school kids shaking tambourines and wearing blankets and taking sort of amphetamines and stuff. So I went to San Diego on a Greyhound bus and smoked dope for the first time. And the first time I felt the effect of Acapulco Gold, I remember it vividly as if it was yesterday. And it was good fun. It was surfing and rock and roll and stuff. And then I came back, went to college, and the first thing I did was find people who smoked dope. And I basically had a 3-year holiday. I mean, these days people have to work at college. I just didn't have to do anything apart from pass exams once a year. We didn't have to show up for... I was doing medical studies, and we really didn't have to do anything. I mean, these days I'm amazed at how hard people work. I ran a mobile discotheque. We'd get up, smoke dope, go and have a few sort of sausages or something, go and see an Andy Warhol film and hang out with sort of cool people. And we were a bit sort of superior to the guys who were actually going to lectures and riding their bicycles and playing rugby and rowing and stuff like that. We were a bit too cool to do that. And then suddenly exams came along and I discovered amphetamines. Some guy in the marketplace said, try these. Amphetamines were my drugs of choice. I just loved the feeling I got taking amphetamines. I learned all my anatomy, stuff like that. Very quickly using amphetamines, no doubt about it. It improved my psychomotor function for a short period of time. And I managed to scrape through a degree, went to medical school, where things started to go wrong, because in those days you could get Valium and Mandrax and things like that off the trolley in the hospital, and I was staying with a bunch of nurses up in Golders Green, and they would come back with, oh, we got you some Mandrax, Brian. Thank you. We've got you some Valium. Oh, great. You know, we've got you some Tylenol. And they could just take it off the... this does not happen today, folks. This is different today. But life became a series of cocktails. I like to think of myself as a cool guy who smoked dope. To be honest, I did not like smoking dope. It made me feel uneasy, edgy. I was not seeing things properly. You could hear the... I don't know, you could hear things differently, or you could hear the kind of bongos on Lay Lady Lay, but I was always, you know, I was paranoid, and I don't use that word. I was just conscious that, I always thought people were saying unpleasant things about me, and I'd end up sort of isolating, and my idea of the years of love and peace were kind of sitting stoned on my own, looking at the ceiling, wishing I was Donovan, waiting for the police to arrive because I was nervous I was going to get arrested, just a bit like Barbara was saying earlier. So it wasn't exactly a whole lot of fun. And I spent more time mucking about with people in the music industry than I did going to medical school. I mean, it's amazing that these days things are so different. And failed my finals the first time around. And they said, look, if you fail again, we're not impressed. You've been found lying face down in Goode Street. All I was trying to do was get to the Northern Line. Didn't quite make it. And I wound up in my own teaching hospital, and they thought I had made a suicide attempt because I'd just taken some Mandrax, had a glass of beer, and fallen over. And I, you know, at the time, it seemed daft. Looking back, when you hear about medical students doing this kind of thing, you know, you kind of raise your eyebrows and think, well, maybe something's not too good here. These days, it's we're all under the microscope. Since... yeah, well, as doctors now, it's a tough business to be in. We are constantly scrutinised and everything's regulated. Since Harold Shipman went around and murdered 300 odd people, whatever it is, and it's a good thing. It's a hassle, but it's a good thing. I qualified in 1974. I got married, and we both qualified as doctors. And she worked in one hospital, I worked in another. It was a daft marriage, really. It was a sort of rebound thing. We both liked the idea of being married. And while I was in my first job, I got a kidney stone. I suffer from kidney stones. I still get them. And I was assisting in an operation, and it wasn't particularly painful, but I said, I think I've got a kidney stone. And he said, well, go to the casualty department. And they took an X-ray. There was a kidney stone. They gave me some pethidine, which is like an opiate. This was quite a wake-up call. I loved this. I thought this was great. I said, well, I'm in a lot more pain, actually. and you know, can we maybe double that, you know? And that went on for a couple of weeks, and then I had surgery. They cut the kidney stone out, but I remembered the feeling. And it's significant to me when I say I'm wired up differently to say my dad. My dad doesn't remember the first time he had a drink. I remember the first time I had an alcoholic drink, the first time I took a Valium, the first time I took a Mandrax, the first time I took... there were significant memories that I still remember vividly. Now, I don't know that everybody feels like that, but I certainly did. And I think that wired up differently means having a different kind of sensitivity to things. I'll start crying in the middle of a, I don't know, knocking on heaven's door or something, and or I'll be, you know, over the top elated. I think, you know, emotionally, it's about bouncing around without using sort of technical terms like bipolar. I don't think I'm bipolar. I think I'm just an addict who is genetically or epigenetically predisposed to things that make me feel good or things that make me feel different. And to cut a sort of longish and pretty dull, boring story fairly short, my wife left because I obviously had a drug problem. And I bounced around sort of writing prescriptions and getting pharmacists to who would eventually cover up for me, you know. And I would get into a pickle. I'd have to leave one job, move on to another. And it just... I just seem to get away with it. I mean, these days, there's just no way that one would be able to do what I did, and there's no way I would have been able to qualify, actually. But at that time, it was possible. And I wound up getting into a bit of trouble, and I wound up at a place called Phoenix House, which was a therapeutic community. I'm sure some people here have heard of it. And it was in South London, and it was tough, and there was a lot of shouting and counter groups. And the idea was it was psychotherapy. You peel away the onions, and then you figure out why you took drugs, and then you live a normal life. And normal life at that time included going to the pub. And so that's what people did. And I stayed there for about 3 or 4 months, and I got there sort of, it wasn't head shaved and really brutal, but it was pretty tough. I had to wear a sign saying, I am a stupid child, I need to grow up. The reason I left was because I ran out of tobacco, actually. And that is the reason why I left. It wasn't that tough. I quite enjoyed all the shouting and the encounter groups and the, you know, trust games and stuff. I don't think it really helped my recovery in retrospect. I learned how to hotwire Volkswagens, and I learned a whole lot of stuff. One thing it did do is I was with a bunch of addicts, and I learned how addicts think, and it's the best clinical experience I've ever had, is spending 3 months in Phoenix House and just being around people who were not using, but they thought like addicts. And I got kicked out because I ran out of tobacco, and basically carried on drinking, and drinking would cause me to relapse back into my drug of choice. And eventually I wound up, my wife divorced me very sensibly, went off and married somebody else, and I wound up in a place that many folk have been to in Weston-super-Mare. And I thought I was some kind of misunderstood guy who liked to live life in the fast lane and was misunderstood by women, and, you know, They said, look, you've got an illness. You're not some sort of existential kind of whatever. You've got an illness, and it's called addiction. It's called alcoholism. And if you continue doing what you're doing, you're going to get really sick. And if you actually stop it and you go to 12-step meetings, you'll get well. And this was too simple for me. I was far too arrogant. I knew far more about than they did. I'd been in Phoenix House. I knew about drug addicts, blah, blah, blah. I learned a bit of pharmacology. And I got kicked out after about 10 weeks with one of the young ladies who I found a lot more interesting than the programme that they were talking about. We both got kicked out together. And she subsequently died from an overdose of heminevrin. I didn't die. I was working in London, working as a casualty officer in the A&E department, and was drinking. And that for me meant, if I was working on the day shift, I would start looking forward to going to the pub about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would get to the pub about six when the shift ended, and that first drink, which would be a bottle of pills, would go down real fast. I wasn't drinking it because I liked the taste of pills. And about once a month, something would happen where I would get into an argument or a fight with somebody, or something not okay would happen. Didn't take any drugs, apart from a couple of times when I found myself getting hold of some pethidine or getting hold of some opiates, and it surprised me because it was the alcohol that caused me to do that. And it shocked me a bit. And some of the messages I got back in treatment were, you know, you can trigger a return to your drug of choice if you take mood-altering chemicals, and alcohol, of course, is a mood-altering chemical. So I was just getting more and more fed up, more and more miserable, and I thought, you know, God, what am I going to do? And I heard an advert on the radio asking for doctors and nurses to go to Cambodia. This was 1979, and there was a big relief operation going on. So I went down, joined the Red Cross. My dad was a military man. This was a kind of military sort of exercise, and I wound up in Thailand working with Cambodian refugees in 1979, there for about 9 months. And in 1980... I got promoted. I did the job really well. We were all, it's a bit like MASH. We were all kind of coming back after a hard day's work, drinking Thai beer, chasing the nurses around, and then going into work very early, usually with a hangover. Didn't take any drugs while I was in Thailand. And we got attacked by Vietnamese troops, which was something that we'd been expecting the whole 9 months I was there. And because I was in Bangkok, this telex came saying, all camp coordinators, come to Geneva immediately, which would have been a bit silly. There were four of us, and people needed to stay there to sort things out. And the compromise was I got on the next Swiss Air flight to Geneva, and I arrived in Geneva, a bit hungover, a bit jet-lagged, furious that I had had to get on a plane and arrive in Geneva. And I arrived in Geneva in June 1980, feeling very weird indeed. It felt very strange coming out of refugee camps into this clean city full of self-conscious, well-dressed Swiss people. And I moved out of the town. I was there for about 10 days, and I had to come in and go up to the Red Cross headquarters, and I was drinking in the evenings. It wasn't anything spectacular. A couple of things happened to me there in Geneva which are special for me, because there were just coincidences. I ran into a few people that I just wasn't expecting to run into. And I remember being led through Geneva Station by this woman who was a complete stranger. And she said, go into that cafe there. You'll be more comfortable. It was a weird day. The train timetables were all different. My French isn't very good. And as I walked through the door of this cafe, the girl I'd been kind of having an affair with in Thailand walked out, and I'd been told she was off in the mountains with her fiancé, and don't ring this number again, and blah, and I'd forgotten about it. And I just said, meet me here tomorrow at 3 o'clock, and she said, okay. And I sat in this cafe having a glass of beer and a croque monsieur, and I just thought, that was not a coincidence. This woman came up to me and led me through this busy station, and if I'd been 10, 15 seconds sooner or later, we would have missed each other. I was led into this meeting. And it had a real effect on me. I remember that as if it was yesterday. It was a mind-altering experience. And I was sitting in this crappy cafe in Geneva Station. I suddenly started to feel quite calm. I started to think, there's something going on here that's just much bigger than anything I've ever experienced. This is not all coincidence. This is part of some kind of bigger plan. And I felt, to my own surprise, quite comfortable with the idea that this was a plan, that a journey that I was on. And somehow, I didn't know where it was going, but I knew at that point that I was going to have to stop drinking, because I'd had a few fights and things that had gone on as a result, purely as a result of drinking alcohol, that had caused trouble. And I got a lot of these messages I'd got in treatment. It's going to get worse. Things will become a problem. Life will be, and I could see very clearly, I was 31 years old, I could see very clearly that I would get to 40, 45, 50, 50. I'm not someone who says if I hadn't found these rooms, I'd be dead by now. I mean, I might have been, but I'm not someone who says that. I was pretty good at surviving. I was pretty good at ducking and diving. I was a functioning, working alcoholic addict who hadn't really hit the kind of rock bottom where you're homeless and on a park bench. That came in recovery. No, I'm kidding. I stopped what I was doing, came back to England, and left the Red Cross and went to the other fellowship. And when I put down, and I didn't really need a detox, when I put down, I felt awful. I was 31 years old. I felt like I was 14. I didn't have much money. I was working, doing various medical jobs around the place, going to the laundromat, watching my socks go around in the dryer, pissed off that the people I was at medical school with were all on their kind of second house and third child and new Volvo, and there I was in the laundromat watching my socks go around. And what I decided to do, I gritted my teeth and made a commitment to myself. I wasn't going to do 90 meetings in 90 days, but I decided to go to 5 meetings a week for a year. And if I still felt like this, because when I put down, this emotional tidal wave came over me. I was laughing one minute, crying the next minute, getting scared on the tube, getting off the tube, walking because the sound, the noise was so loud. You know, I was quite phobic. I had all this kind of shit going on. Didn't know how to talk to anybody, had no social skills without a drink inside me. And I felt really rotten. But I made this commitment to go to 5 meetings a week for a year. And I told myself, number one, if I do this, it will not do me any harm. So I did it because I knew it wouldn't do me any harm. Number two, I told myself, if I still feel like shit after a year, I can drink, I can go to Australia, I can do whatever, but I'm going to do this for a year. It was a really bloody-minded thing. I didn't want to go to 12-step meetings. I didn't want all this God stuff, this American kind of ritualistic stuff. My mum had actually been going to AA, and I'd been to a few meetings with him. But I decided to do it someone else's way, and I made a firm, and it was actually a gentle commitment. There was no burning bush, there was no thunderbolt, it was a gentle thing. I'm going to do this because it won't do me any harm. And I started to do that, and I just went to meetings. Did a pediatric job, actually. I went to Wolverhampton, did pediatrics, because in Cambodia I realized I knew nothing about sick kids. And it was kind of interesting on my CV now, by the way. Suddenly a pediatric job, and then I started doing psychiatry because I thought, you know, maybe we'll start thinking about working in the world of addictions. And basically all I did was show up, and it took me a while before this eased off. I felt horrible for 3 months. I was a tough nut to crack. I would show up late. I would, you know, think, well, you know, he's lying and he's screwing her and she's taking Valium and blah, blah. And I really didn't believe it was anything special. Until one day in Hines Street on a Monday night, it was a 7 o'clock Monday night meeting, and again, it was a mood-altering experience. I found myself somehow relaxing. I wasn't even listening to what was being said. I just found myself rocking gently, and I realized, it was like my first drink or like my first Valium, that I had tapped into something that was in this room that was actually very powerful. It was subtle, but it was powerful, and it was gentle, and it was nourishing, and it was healing, and it wasn't anything to do with anything powerful. It was no bright lights, thunderbolts, nothing. It was gentle, and recovery for me has been gentle. And one of the things I did, I went back to treatment, actually, after a year, and they didn't have to tell me to stop drinking, stop using, go to meetings, because I knew that. But for me, going back to treatment was probably the best thing I've ever done. And I recommend a lot of people going to treatment. If I'm going to become a helicopter pilot, I need to go to helicopter school to learn how to be a helicopter pilot. And it makes sense to me to go to treatment if that's something one can do. I certainly don't discourage it, which some folk do. And what happened was NA kicked off after my first year of so-called recovery. And it really wasn't much of a recovery. It was going to meetings and being pretty lonely. NA started in Chelsea, in Millman Street, and it was started by an AA member, and there were a few people who were going along there, and it was interesting. I didn't really know much about it. Somebody said, have you tried going to NA? And I didn't even know if I qualified for NA. I mean, I was told, look, you know, you've never taken sort of heroin in using water from toilets in Piccadilly Circus. You're not really a junkie, you're not really an addict. And so I was a bit nervous, you know, and actually NA at that time was largely started by middle class kind of ex-public schoolboys, ex-university people who'd come out of private treatment centres, and that was the majority of the number of people who went to NA. And it was all a bit of a club for a while, and then it became exciting because people started to really get recovery, and NA started to spread like wildfire, and then it would fold, and it was crazy, and people would sort of steal the pot and stick it up their arm and stuff like that. And NA started, it just kind of got, it was, we all tried to control it, we all tried to keep it in Millman Street, and then Margaret Street, tried to open things, and it just ran away like a train, and it just turned into this amazing organization that it now is. Some of us went to Memphis to write some of the literature, to a literature writing conference that I now discover was regarded as an illegal conference by the World, what's it called? Not the World Trade Center, the World Service Commission. Yeah, it was illegal. We wrote some of the bits and bobs that on some of the leaflets and things and in Memphis. And, yeah, you know, it was exciting. It was up and down. And then recovery kind of became a gentle journey. It was... and I started working in the field of addictions. I started doing psychiatry in order to be able to do that. And so work kind of happened, and all I did was show up, and I just did what's suggested. And it's always made sense to me. I mean, quite often it's felt like a miraculous journey, but actually whatever you want to do, if you want to be healthy, you know, eat well, sleep well, do exercise, and provided you've got a reasonable genetic makeup, chances are you'll be healthier than if you don't do the sensible things. And it's always been obvious to me that if you just show up at this organization that makes you feel relaxed and nourishing, and you know, there are friends who come up to you, and there are people in this room I've known for years who, you know, we don't all go on holiday together, we don't all kind of love each other all the time. There are one or two I've had a pretty serious arguments with, but we kind of forgive and sort of stick to the principles that are just so obvious, really. And it's always been a no-brainer for me that if you just do it, it's not what we say, it's what we do. And if you just show up and just kind of open up to the very simple ideas that are in these rooms, you can't really go wrong unless you've got some serious other problem. And most of us haven't. I work now with a lot of people, a lot of therapists, a lot of psychiatrists who are always diagnosing bipolar and whatever. This stuff is actually usually pretty straightforward, and most of the problems are actually caused by addiction rather than the other way around. Although there are one or two, there are a few people who probably do need some other medication as well, and I'm, you know, very open to that. So recovery for me has been a journey, like lots of people talk about. I got married again. I have now an ex-wife. I'm not good at relationships. I mean, really not good. The addictive thing, it affects lots of different areas of my life. I've still got character defects. I know I get intolerant. I know when I'm tired. All the basic stuff, when I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, fed up, working too hard, whatever. I get irritable. I get off beam. I get snappy. And I'm a difficult person to live with. I'm 65. And I don't really want to get to 70 and be on my own, but it's going to be quite a special kind of woman who decides to be my partner, I can tell you. It's not that easy living with me, and I'm 34 years clean today, the 11th of July, 1980. That's really, really nice of you. It really doesn't need... It's been not an effort. It's been not difficult. I have been very lucky. I've never had a craving for any alcohol or any drug. Once I made that decision to do this, it kind of just took over. And after that year, it started to become fun. I started to notice, I don't know, the magnolia blossom and daft things like that. I started to feel in a childlike, not childish, but childlike state of just learning all this stuff. And that's kind of gone on. And it's not all been fun. I mean, my marriage was not great. I'm not proud of it. I was really not able to cope with somebody. But we've got three fantastic children. They're now in their 20s. One's engaged. and the other two are identical twins. And one of them was performing at Glastonbury a couple of weeks ago. And so I flew back from America, drove to Glastonbury, parked, walked through mud for an hour to get to the bloody stage in the pissing rain, watched the act that she was in, and which was great. And I did actually stay at Glastonbury. I was jet-lagged and I was pretty grumpy. And I could not cope with all the drunken stone people who were kind of splashing each other with mud and shouting during the set I wanted to listen to. I was actually quite irritable. I will never go to Glastonbury again, folks. It's not all perfect. And I was grumpy and jet-lagged, but my little girl did great. And I think life needs to be kept simple. I go to meetings when I'm feeling cranky. I know when I need a meeting. And I know that when I go to a meeting and if I just let it waft over me, I will leave that meeting feeling better than I did when I walked in. And I have this thing that I often say to patients, we all need someone or something to love. It might be a pet. We all need something to do, and we all need something to look forward to. And those are the three kind of ingredients that we all need other than a roof over our head and shelter and nourishment and stuff like that. There. Someone to love, something to do, something to look forward to. So I've got kids that I love, and there are a few people that I love. It can be a pet. I've got something to do most of the time, although I'm easing back a bit. I'll never retire. I wouldn't know what to do when I retire. And sometimes I've got something to look forward to. Right now, it's all a bit kind of so-so, but when I've got something to love, something to do, someone to love, something to do, something to look forward to, things are pretty good. So for me, recovery has been... I have to be a bit more selfish now. I find myself... I'm pretty codependent. I will get involved with things that don't necessarily make sense. I still have character defects. I still go over the top with things. My other kind of thing is about I'm really hopeless at technology. I'm really struggling with the iPhone. I get very irritated with it. It tells me I've got messages or voicemails. I can't retrieve them, stuff like that. And I have this thing that, you know, information is not knowledge, and knowledge is not wisdom. And for me, the important wisdom is the wisdom to know the difference, as in the Serenity Prayer. So it's great to be with everybody here. I'm sorry for the mics being popping. Thanks for asking me to do this. And thank you all very much for being here. Thanks.